Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
The world's top diplomats gather to Vienna, hoping to strike a deal for Iran's nuclear program. And Tunisia holds democratic elections. I'm Marty Johnson reporting from Washington. Foreign ministers from as many as seven countries are gathering in Vienna for the final push to the Monday midnight deadline on talks on the future of Iran's nuclear program. All have been deputized by the United Nations, but some may be more effective than others, as VOA's Al Pessin reports from Vienna.
The six nations have been deputized by the UN Security Council to negotiate with Iran and find a formula that would allow it to maintain a peaceful nuclear program with verifiable limits and guarantees it could never build a nuclear weapon. In return, Iran wants relief from crippling economic sanctions. Officials indicate that the extent and timing of all aspects are still in play. Meanwhile, the effort to reach an agreement faces considerable opposition. A protest in Iran Sunday called for no compromise on the key issue of the country's plutonium reactor. Al Pessin, VOA News, Vienna.
Witnesses and authorities in Nigeria say suspected Boko Haram gunmen have killed at least 25 people in the country's northeast. They say the victims were mostly fishermen in the remote community of Doron Baga, north of Maiduguri in Borno State. Some witnesses put the death toll at higher than 40. Boko Haram is blamed for thousands of deaths during its five-year insurgency in the region. Tunisians vote today for their first directly elected president since the 2011 revolution that led to the Arab Spring pro-democracy uprisings. Today's vote marks the long-awaited completion of a transition to democracy after Tunisians overthrew dictator Zine El Abidine Ben Ali 3 years ago. There are more than 20 candidates, but 87-year-old Bazi Kahid Ebsebi appears to be in the front, followed by the current president, Moncef Marzouki. This is VOA News. Afghan officials say a suicide bomber has killed more than 40 people and wounded dozens more at a volleyball tournament. The match in the northeast Paktika province had drawn a large crowd. The attack came the same day that Afghanistan's lower parliament house approved security agreements with the U.S. and NATO, allowing international forces to remain in the country past the end of this year in support of local forces. Parliament's action follows news that President Barack Obama issued new guidelines expanding the U.S. military's ability to confront Taliban fighters, not just al-Qaeda, in Afghanistan. Chinese officials say an earthquake has hit a thinly populated area of western China, leaving at least four people dead and more than 50 injured. The U.S. Geological Survey put the magnitude of the quake at 5.9 with a depth of 14 kilometers and said that it struck Saturday afternoon in Sichuan province. Some homes completely collapsed. Many others were damaged. Meantime, cleanup has begun in the mountainous area of central Japan where a 6.8 magnitude quake struck Saturday night, injuring at least 39 and causing several homes to collapse. The quake was centered near Nagano and felt as far away as Tokyo. The Japan Meteorological Agency said the quake occurred at a depth of 10 kilometers and occurred inland, so no tsunami warnings were issued. 5 years after 58 people, more than half of them media workers, were killed in the southern Philippines, there have been no convictions and scores of suspects remain at large. From Manila, Simone Orendine reports.
Philippine and international journalists are remembering the massacre in Maguindanao province on November 23, 2009, with a repeated call for justice. Mike Dobby of the International Federation of Journalists calls the Philippine justice system broken.
There seem to be no substantial reasons for why these 84 suspects have not been rounded up. We know the justice system is broken because at least four witnesses have been killed before they can give their evidence.
The main suspects belong to a powerful political clan, the Ampatuans, and have all pleaded not guilty to carrying out the ambush that saw the wife and sisters of their political rival, as well as supporters and 32 journalists, killed. Simone Orendine for VOA News, Manila.
A grand jury decision previously expected today is now delayed until at least Monday in the case of the killing of unarmed African-American teenager by a white police officer in the St. Louis, Missouri suburb of Ferguson. Members of the grand jury are gathering information about the August death of 18-year-old Michael Brown at the hands of Officer Darren Wilson. Marion Barry, a sharecropper's son and civil rights activist who became a beloved mayor of Washington, D.C., has died.
Preserve. Protect.
Barry was first elected Washington's mayor in 1978. He had a string of accomplishments as well as major failures, but was beloved of the town. He died at 78. I'm Marty Johnson.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
Secretary General announced the World Health Organization official, top official in the country to head the UNMI office in Mali. And that's underway as we speak.
The United Nations plans to establish an office in Mali to help with efforts to contain the Ebola disease.
I don't think that there will be much of the changes that we should expect at the ZANU-PF Congress. As we have seen, ZANU-PF is very much willing to work.
A diplomat says conflict within the Zimbabwean ruling ZANU-PF party is normal in any political discourse.
We talk about a continent that's been ruled by dictators and corruption. We talk about Africa sometimes as hopeless. And I'm here to tell you that that is absolutely not the case.
And Melinda Gates, wife of the founder of Microsoft, wins an award for her humanitarian work. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The United Nations Mission for Ebola Emergency Response, or UNMIR, is establishing an office in Mali to help support efforts to combat and contain the Ebola virus, according to Ari Gaitanis, head of the Public Information Unit at the UN. Gaitanis told me that the decision to establish an office in Mali came after UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon held a conversation with Malian President Ibrahim Boubacar Keita.
This all stems from a meeting and a visit to Mali by Tony Bambury, the top UN official on the Ebola emergency response. He visited Mali where he met with a range of partners, both international and national, involved in the response efforts in the country. Amongst his meetings, he met the president of Mali, and they discussed the possibility of UNMIR, the UN mission, having some sort of presence in the country to help support the country's Ebola response efforts. Yesterday, the Secretary General of the United Nations, Ban Ki-moon, spoke with the President, who confirmed his request. And afterwards, the Secretary General told Mr. Banbury that he'd like to see UNMIR have an office established there right away. That is happening pretty much as we speak. The Secretary General announced the World Health Organization official, top official in the country, to head the UNMIR office in Mali. And that's underway as we speak. And we're also evaluating and studying what kind of presence we need, how many staff, what kind of resources are required. So, again, that's all in motion from the day it was announced.
What specifically will be the objective of this office, and how far will it go to help with Mali's fight to combat this dreaded disease?
Well, the government of Mali has taken action already to deal with Ebola within its borders. The key thing here, and in some ways you could almost say, you know, sadly the fortunate thing, is that there's a chance for you to learn from the experience of other countries that have been affected by Ebola. You know, for example, Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. And UNMIR has, you know, lessons learned, of course, and has experience already in this sort of crisis response. And the fact is that Mali now has a very small number of cases compared to others, and this means there's a chance to end it quickly before it becomes a true crisis, the way it has become in other countries.
Talking about lessons learned, will the office also have an extension of helping some of these other countries, including Liberia, Sierra Leone and Guinea, in their fight against the disease?
Well, of course, in the sense that, you know, we've already have had experience in the other three countries. I mean, there's no way we can ignore the facts of what we've learned. So definitely there will be knowledge brought to bear from our previous experiences in Liberia, Guinea and Sierra Leone.
Ari Gaitanis is the head of the Public Information Unit at the UN. He spoke with me from the Guinean capital, Accra. Tunisians are voting in the country's first presidential election since the 2011 Arab Spring that triggered uprisings across the region. The poll is part of a political transition following the revolution that ousted Zine El Abidine Ben Ali. Professor Walid Fares is an advisor to the U.S. House of Representatives on Middle East and author of The Law Spring. My colleague Douglas Impuga reached him in Washington and asked him why Tunisia is succeeding where others have failed.
Tunisia was the first playground of what was called the Arab Spring in 2011. It inspired many, but its own political forces have played differently. They were very fast in making that change, the initial change. They took their time to produce the political system to elect another government. The secular opposition, the liberal secular opposition, gave role to women, gave role to youth, which allowed them to rise in peaceful demonstrations against the Nahda party when it tried to establish a non-democratic regime. But at the same time, the Nahda party, which is an Islamist party, was rational enough not to respond with violence. So it seems that most players in Tunisia, with the exception of the Al-Qaeda-linked jihadists in the south, including the army, of course, that played its own stabilizing role, welcomed a new type of democracy. It is not yet perfect, but this is the kind of democratic transition that other Arab countries should be going through.
Tunisia is in the region where, as you just mentioned, Islamists are taking hold, and other countries in the region have not been able to transition peacefully to a new dispensation. What sets Tunisia apart?
I think it's the political culture of its own people. Large segments of the Tunisian population have been educated under the previous regimes. Large segments of its civil society were already part of civil and political action, including the workers' union, very important, women's organizations, student organizations. So the level of civil society in Tunisia was already advanced. It's a smaller country than other countries. It doesn't have oil, which complicates usually these issues. And at the same time, its army was trained not to be ideological. If you look at all these factors, it's an alignment of planet, which made the transition in Tunisia better than in other places. But the jury is still out. Let's see what are the final results of all these elections and how Tunisia is going to fare in the future. The real challenge is going to be if the Islamist opposition will remain in opposition and won't be tempted to have some of its parts joining the jihadists in the south.
You mentioned the role of Islamists in the region. How should Tunisia control against the spread of Islamist extremism in the country?
There are three ways that the Tunisian democratically elected government can help in stemming the tide of jihadism and Islamic extremism. Number one is that the government engage in serious counter-radicalization efforts, and that's something that secular Tunisians know how to do. Number two, the moderates, Islamic parties of Tunisia have to make a choice, and that choice is to distance themselves not just politically but ideologically and condemn the jihadist Salafi ideology. And number three, very important, is for Tunisia and the countries that are now facing off with the jihadists, that would be Egypt, Saudi, UAE, Bahrain, Kuwait, Jordan, all these moderate countries should come together and coordinate, create a local bloc, North African and Middle Eastern bloc, works against the jihadists and help the African countries who are struggling, as in Nigeria and in the Sahel.
That was Professor Walid Fares, an advisor to the U.S. House of Representatives on Middle East and author of The Law Spring. He spoke with my colleague Douglas Impuga. In Indesima, in the eastern part of the Central African Republic, lies one of the world's largest artisanal gold mines. It was once run by a Canadian mining company and the government. Now ex-Seleka rebels control the mine and its revenues. The government has lost all control over the gold and diamond trade, further deepening the country's crisis. For VOA, Katerina Hoiji, who traveled to the Central African Republic, has more on the story.
From the edge of the crater, an armed man boxes orders in broken Sango. 50 meters down, at the bottom of the giant man-made pit, the miners look up at their new boss. As foreign gold and diamond mine operators left the country, fleeing the conflict in the Central African Republic, anti-Balaka militia and Seleka rebels gradually replaced them. In the village of Ndaisima, in the eastern Kar, the Seleka have taken control of the mine and its revenues.
Nous sommes des habitants centrafricains, mais il n'y a pas de gouvernement maintenant. Nous travaillons seulement.
Now it's the rebels who buy our gold. They also control the mine and the workers, says Frederick Ningando, a miner. When the Seleka rebels took his hometown of Bria in December 2012, Ningando left the mining town in the northeastern Kar to look for work. He arrived in Ndaisima only to discover the rebels had made it there before him. When the National Army fled, the Seleka positioned themselves as protectors of miners and collectors, demanding monthly protection payments from agencies and mine workers. The foreign diamond collectors don't dare to come here anymore, says Ibrahim Kudege, a trader who buys gold from miners nearby. The miners in Ndaisima transport and sell their gold in Bambari, the nearest major town. There they deal with traders from Chad and Sudan who have replaced the buyers who used to come from Bangui. The road to Bambari is controlled by the rebels who often act as middlemen. We cooperate with the Seleka while we're waiting for the government to come back, says Kudege. As there's no security on the road and people from the mine travel with a lot of money, we depend on the rebels. The smuggling of gems and gold is one of the biggest challenges facing the Dakar's fragile transitional government. Smugglers move their wares out of the country. The levy the Dakar applies on the value of diamond exports is 12% compared to 3.2% in the Democratic Republic of Congo and 5% in Congo-Brazzaville. For gold, the rate in Cameroon is also lower than in the Dakar. Car mining companies now fear Cameroon's recent membership in the Kimberley Process will increase the smuggling. The Kimberley Process, an international agreement to prevent trade in conflict diamonds, stopped all legal trade with diamonds from the Dakar more than 18 months ago. While the miners in Ndaisima say they feel the effect of the international trade ban, the ad trade continues almost like before. Gold is always easy to sell. The control on diamonds is much stricter, says Kudege. Here, however, everything is done by hand. We don't have any machines to dig and extract the gold. It's hard work for very little money. We wait for the mining companies to return. That is not likely to happen any time soon. Despite the presence of French troops and UN peacekeepers, fighting between ex-Seleka and anti-Balaka, as well as clashes between armed cattle herders, threatened security in areas until recently considered relatively safe. Security in the mine has deteriorated since the government left. During the rains in September, part of the mine collapsed, killing at least 27 miners. Several others are believed to be buried under the slippery mud. For 2 weeks, all work in the mine stopped. But the miners are back at work, fearful the walls around them will collapse, and worried about the men who now control their livelihoods. This is Katrina Heyer for VOA News in Bamako.
The European ambassador to Zimbabwe, Philip Van Damme, says there's nothing unusual about the ongoing infighting in ZANU-PF ahead of the party's December Congress. Mr. Van Damme says the nature of politics the world over means at one stage or the other, opponents will fight for political space. VOA Studio 7's reporter Ivan Chifera has details from the Zimbabwean capital, Harare.
Responding to questions after making a presentation on the future of Zimbabwe-European Union relations at the Southern African Political and Economic Series Trust, Van Damme said, while it is not the duty of diplomats to discuss internal party politics, what's happening in ZANU-PF is not unusual in politics.
I have been asked the last couple of weeks also by journalists, what's the impact of factionalism? I don't know. I mean, all over the world, parties fight for power. Everywhere in the world, within parties, people fight for power. I don't know what will be the outcome. I leave it to the experts here to speculate about the outcome of factionalism. So I don't know what will be the impact of that.
The international community is obviously watching events in Harare closely, but has largely been silent as the infighting in ZANU-PF intensifies ahead of its elective Congress in December. First Lady Grace Mugabe has intimated in her speeches attacking Vice President Joyce Mujuru that her husband's deputy has been working with some Western countries in an effort to eliminate President Mugabe from office. Several representatives of foreign governments approached by Studio 7 refused to comment, saying the infighting was an internal matter. Some political political analyst told Studio 7, while the international community is extremely concerned about the goings on in ZANU-PF, they will not comment publicly, as doing so would be violating the law on diplomatic relations. Political commentator Blessing Vava says the international community does not want to be seen to be interfering in Zimbabwe's internal politics.
I think the international community is very much concerned about what is happening in ZANU-PF, but they wouldn't want to be seen involved in the internal affairs of ZANU-PF until the party goes for its Congress.
Vava says with President Robert Mugabe now 90 years old, many Zimbabweans and the international community are anxious to know who would take charge of the ruling party and possibly the country. He said even though the EU has lifted sanctions on Zimbabwe, ZANU-PF is likely to continue with its lookist policy after the Congress.
I don't think that there will be much of the changes that we should expect at the ZANU-PF Congress. As we have seen, ZANU-PF is very much willing to work with the East rather than the West. So I'm not seeing any policy shifts in terms of ZANU-PF's foreign policy.
But other experts told Studio 7 that ZANU-PF looks keen to work with European and international partners, as witnessed by the recent visits by business delegations from Britain and Denmark. Van Dem said the EU is already supporting Zimbabwe in a number of areas, including the implementation of the International Monetary Fund's staff monitored program. Reporting for Studio 7 from Harare, this is Ivan Chifera.
This past week, Michel Kafando was sworn in as transitional president of Burkina Faso. He will lead the country to democratic elections 1 year from now. Lieutenant Colonel Isaac Zida was named prime minister. Ernest Hirsch is an adjunct associate professor at Columbia University's School of International and Public Affairs. VOA reporter William Eagle talked with him about the new interim government and about its president, Michel Kafando.
Both the civilian negotiators and the military negotiators put forward several names. So he wasn't the military pick. He was the one they sort of all agreed on. They had also suggested a Josephine Ouédraogo, the military did, and she had been a minister under Sankara, but she apparently wasn't interested in the position. The names the civilians put forward, there was an archbishop who also didn't want it, and the names of two newspaper editors, and they were seen as generally having not much political experience. I mean, they were good journalists and critical of Kompaoré, but were not seen as having sufficient weight to carry through the transition period. Kafando himself is very little known to most Burkinabe, or people outside the country. He's been a diplomat his whole life. I'm going by the official biographies. And he was foreign minister quite some time ago. That was in the early 1980s. Some of the opposition groups reproach him a little bit for having been close. Well, they say he was too close to Kompaoré because he was ambassador to the UN at some point in the late 90s, early 2000s. He had been ambassador to the UN under a previous regime as well. And he was known to have been sort of on the outs politically when the revolutionary government of Thomas Sankara came in. But his role is basically as a caretaker. He won't be allowed to run, like other members of the government, won't be allowed to run in the elections that will probably be held in November 2015. And there's a lot of forces involved in the new transitional government. So it's not like, you know, the president, although there is a strong executive, you know, he won't be able to change course very much. There'll be a lot of countervailing forces trying to keep things on track. So his identity, you know, is less consequential, I think, though, you know, we could be wrong. And a lot, I think, might depend on what his role is or his any alliance he may have with the military, which we really don't know. I wouldn't read too much into the fact that the military put forward his name, but I wouldn't discount it either. You know, it's just a lot that we don't know yet.
Who are the groups competing for power in Burkina Faso? Are they regional or ethnic groups? For example, are any represented or overrepresented within the military?
I think the military is quite mixed. certainly at the officer corps. It's traditionally, it's never been dominated by a single ethnic group. The Mosi are about half of the entire country. So, you know, they'll be dominant in whatever you put together. But other ethnic groups will be represented as well. Historically, you have not had great regional and ethnic tensions in Burkina Faso, unlike some other countries in the region. I don't want to say they're not there, but it hasn't been a major factor in the country's political life.
I understand that some who are influential in the opposition are followers of the late President Thomas Sankara. Can you tell us more about that? Are they active elements of the opposition, labor, civil society, etc.?
There are different people and different groups at different levels. And, you know, to say one's a follower of Sankara can mean different things. You know, generally sort of a radical revolutionary outlook. There's the official opposition parties, and, you know, you lose count of how many there are. I mean, the country has over 70 parties. 40-some-odd or count themselves as part of the opposition. Of those, maybe a half-dozen call themselves Sankarist. The largest one had a few deputies in the last National Assembly. Then there's a lot of younger people who are active in various civil society groups, not so much in the trade unions, but, you know, human rights organizations, and a lot of unaffiliated young folks who sort of, you know, Sankara was their hero, is kind of a mythical figure of somebody who stood up to against corruption. And, of course, if you don't like Compaoré, what better way to express that than to say you're a supporter of the president that Compaoré had assassinated in his military coup.
That was Professor Ernest Hash of Columbia University's School of International and Public Affairs. He spoke with VOA reporter William Eagle. And Melinda Gates, co-founder of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and wife of the former Microsoft boss, has been awarded the annual prize by Policy Institute Chatham House in London. The award is given to the person judged to have made the most significant contribution to the improvement of international relations in the previous year. For VOA, Henry Ridgewell reports from London.
Melinda Gates and her husband Bill launched their foundation in 2000 with the aim of improving lives through healthcare and access to education and technology. At a ceremony in London Friday night, Britain's Prince William paid tribute to her work.
With her equally remarkable husband Bill, Melinda set up the Gates Foundation to change the world. And change it she has. Transforming the lives of women, the poor, the sick, and the disadvantaged in Africa and elsewhere.
The foundation is deeply involved in the fight against Ebola. Melinda Gates warned against generalizations.
People talk about the runaway Ebola epidemic, which is absolutely crucial to talk about, and it's devastating. But we also connect other issues to it that we shouldn't. We talk about a continent that's been ruled by dictators and corruption. We talk about Africa sometimes as hopeless, and I'm here to tell you that that is absolutely not the case.
Most recently, the foundation has given $5.7 million towards blood plasma trials as a treatment for Ebola. Gates warned that the disease was knocking flat the health systems in the affected countries of Guinea, Sierra Leone, and Liberia.
There'll be almost 800,000 births this year in those countries. The women aren't going to clinic now because, one, the clinics are being devastated, but, two, they're terrified to go that they're going to get Ebola. What's the biggest killer of women today, age 15 to 29? Childbirth.
Chatham House commended the foundation's work on the eradication of polio. The UN says Africa could be polio-free in 2015. The foundation has invested in mobile technology across the developing world, transforming the ability of farmers to connect to potential buyers and sellers. Melinda Gates has in recent years directed much of the foundation's work towards improving women's rights, health and education.
If I say, how in my lifetime can I double the impact of what the foundation has? It's by taking this gender lens and focusing on women and girls.
Access to contraception is high on the foundation's agenda.
Women will tell you over and over again, I cannot negotiate a condom, even in my own marriage, because I'm either suggesting...
That was Henry Ridgewell's report. This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotty, in Washington. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, sports with Segun Adeyemi from the Nigerian commercial capital, Lagos, and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sport, and for that, let's go to Lagos, Nigeria, and join Segun Adeyemi. Good evening, Segun.
Good evening, Africa. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports for Sunday, November 23rd. It is now 54 days to the kickoff of the 2015 Africa Cup of Nations. The 2015 tournament will be the 30th edition of the two-yearly football extravaganza. After Morocco backed out from hosting the tournament due to Ebola fears, African soccer's governing body, CAF, gave the hosting rights to Equatorial Guinea. The 2015 tournament will mark the second time that Equatorial Guinea will play host to the tournament. The country co-hosted with Gabon the 2012 edition, which was won by Zambia. Well, all the 16 finalists for next year's tournament have now emerged after the conclusion of the qualifiers last Wednesday. Joining host Equatorial Guinea in the finals are Algeria, Burkina Faso, Cameroon, Cape Verde, Congo-Brazzaville, Democratic Republic of Congo, Gabon, Ghana, Guinea, Ivory Coast, Mali, Senegal, South Africa, Tunisia, and Zambia. Conspicuously missing from the list is Nigeria, which is the current African champion. Nigeria needed to beat South Africa in their final group qualifier on Wednesday to pick the tickets to the finals. However, it could only manage a draw, which means it will not be traveling to Equatorial Guinea for the finals. For a quick perspective on Nigeria's failure to reach the finals, I spoke with Vincent Tobi, a Nigerian sports analyst.
What is your take on the fact that the African champion will not be defending his title at the Africa Cup of Nations next year?
My take is very simple. They got what they deserve. Shoddy preparation, neglect for the other teams or the opponents. And when we lost to Congo at home, it's best easy for us. That's my take on that.
Okay, now that Nigeria is out, this is like the culmination of the state of the football affairs in this country. Where do we go from here? What would you advise the football authorities to do to build a strong Super Eagles team?
First and foremost, I think our coaches will have to go for training. If we insist on not taking foreign coaches, then they have to prepare a program, a training program for our local coaches. So that I'm sure in the last 2-3 years, no local coach in Nigeria has gone for any training abroad. So that is the result we're getting. I think the NFF, that the Football Federation, will have to go back to the drawing board and try and organize good training programs for our local coaches. Otherwise, let them go for a foreign coach. So that's what I think they should do before they can start building a very good Super Eagles.
That was Vincent Tobi, a Nigerian sports analyst. He spoke with me on telephone from Lagos on Nigeria's failure to reach the finals of the 2015 Africa Cup of Nations. Many thanks, Vincent. One team that made it to Equatorial Guinea, despite all the odds, is Guinea. Guinea is one of the three countries in West Africa that are most affected by the Ebola virus disease. Over 1,000 Guineans have so far died of the virus. Because of the disease, Guinea had to play its home games in the qualifying series at a neutral venue, Morocco. Morocco allowed the Sili National, as the Guinean team is known, to play its home games in Casablanca, but the players had to undergo temperature checks twice daily. Guinea coach Michel Dussuyer, however, thanked Morocco, which allowed his team to play its qualifiers in Casablanca and Benin, where the team held training camps. Guinea now needs to find a training venue for 2 weeks in January before the start of the tournament. Meanwhile, CAF says it is reopening media accreditation process for the final draw of the tournament. The process, which started last Thursday, will round off on November 27th. CAF says the media accreditation was reopened following the announcement of Equatorial Guinea as the new host of the 2015 tournament. The final draw for the 16 qualified teams will be held on December 3rd in Malabo, Equatorial Guinea. In a related development, Egypt has sacked coach Shoki Garib for failing to qualify the country for the 2015 Nations Cup. Egypt missed out on the finals in Equatorial Guinea when a 2-1 defeat in Tunisia on Wednesday left it out of contention for the third best placed team. The 55-year-old Garib, who won the tournament as a player in 1986, was appointed in 2013, replacing American Bob Bradley. Egypt is the most successful team at the Nations Cup, having won the title 7 times. Back here in Nigeria, Habu Gumel was elected president of the Nigeria Olympic Committee, NOC, on Thursday. Gumel polled 19 votes to defeat incumbent Sani Ndanusa, who got 17 votes. Finally, Lionel Messi broke the Spanish league's all-time scoring record on Saturday. He surpasses the previous 251-goal mark by scoring a hat-trick in Barcelona's 5-1 defeat of Sevilla. Athletic Bilbao's Telmo Zara set the milestone in 271 La Liga games from 1940 to 1955. Playing in his 298th league match, the 27-year-old Messi first equaled Zara's record in the 21st minute and then beat it in the 72nd. The Argentine went on to get his third goal in the 78th minute, marking his 253rd league goal. Messi's latest scoring feat comes after he equaled Raul Gonzalez as the Champions League's all-time scorer with 71 goals this month. That ends it for this weekend's edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Thanks a lot for listening. I'm Segun Adeyemi in Lagos.
Thanks a lot, Segun. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent.
My head blow. epaizuwa ya bilokoe
Bakuta kingana yangoe
Ikambo mokemo salako boma
Biloko ya ndakoe
Na zumba Na lebie Mario na bayeyo Kende Mario na lembio
Mario Okutinga na biloko mombali mosusu a zumba Mario, 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 Mario,
Mobale akutinga na bomengo asengi ya komandenga na ndimi Mobale akutinga na bangenge asengi ya dirijenga na ndimi Na bandiko bimana ye,
babandiko penga ye, monsieur
Mario abimbi moto,
akanisi biloko na ngaya ye
Mario na baye yo Kende Mario na
Tangwa kola la beto mokuse makolo mila I Mario Mario na lembi Somba beto na baye Mario na lembi
Koyoka motema pasite Nakonga mokona
And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Good evening, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. There was much consternation and excitement in the international community, particularly in Africa, when it was announced after the death of Zambian President Michael Sata in London last October that an ethnic white citizen of Zambia, Dr. Guy Scott would become the head of state of Zambia as acting president. He will remain so until elections are held on 20 January 2015. The general surprise that a white man has become the acting president of Zambia exposed the ignorance of many of what the struggle against white minority rule in Southern Africa was all about. The liberation movements against white minority rule was never against bona fide white citizens of the countries concerned. In fact, the leadership stressed often that they were in support of a non-racial society. The only non-exception was the Pan-African Congress of South Africa under apartheid, and they were clearly opposed to what they called the Boers in South Africa. But the charismatic leader, Nelson Mandela, left no doubt that he was supporting a non-racial South Africa. In fact, when he became president, he surprised many when he championed the white rugby team, which is so much beloved by white South Africans. Perhaps an open secret of the liberation struggle was the fact that some white citizens joined the liberation struggle. Those who could not fight but were against white minority rule and apartheid emigrated from these countries to other parts of the world. Yet, it is unquestionable that the white population in southern Africa are sometimes viewed with some suspicion. Take, for example, the case of the South African opposition party, the Democratic Alliance. Its leader, Miss Ellen Zille, has made special efforts to wipe out the image of a white party. It has been a long struggle, but in the last election, the Alliance Party did make inroads in areas around the commercial city of Johannesburg. The party, the Western Alliance, is very strong in the Western Cape, and there is much expectation that with further effort and increased membership of the Party of Black South Africans, it may be able to challenge the ANC. Despite the surprise outside of Zambia that Dr. Guy Scott was named the acting president of Zambia, it is important to note that not all Zambians support it. However, owing to the recent power struggle within the ruling Patriotic Front, in where Dr. Scott seems to be supporting one faction, there has been a great criticism of some of his action. For example, when President Sata left for London for medical attention, he named the Secretary General of the Patriotic Front, Mr. Egner Lungu, as his stand-in. But when he died, the party named him as the acting president. Shortly thereafter, however, he stripped Mr. Lungu of his position as Secretary General of the party. But party pressure forced him to reinstate him. Now, we have just been informed late last week that the Central Committee of the Patriotic Front has now suspended the acting president as a member of the Patriotic Front, although he will remain acting president of Zambia. The dispute seems to surround who should be the next flag bearer of the party in the elections in January. Dr. Scott would like the choice to be made by a wider conference of the party, but Mr. Lungu would prefer that the 53-member Central Committee, where he is supposed to have much support, be the instrument. This is the struggle that is now ongoing in Zambia and may explain why the party has just suspended him as the leader of the Patriotic Front. But we should bear in mind that Dr. Scott, under the Constitution of Zambia, himself cannot contest the presidential election because his parents were not born in Zambia. It is also true that in the dispute between the two factions within the Patriotic Front, Dr. Scott has very strong support. We will have to wait and see how this plays out. But it is very good that we have one clear example in Africa where the Africans are not concerned with the color of the skin, but how someone performs his or her task. I thank you.
And thank you very much. That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, Managing Editor Shaka Sali, Reporter Douglas Impuga, Producer Odette Frazier, Sports Editor Shegun Adeyemi, and our engineer for today, Brian Makulie, we say thanks for joining us. And as Igbo elders in Nigeria say, a snake that swallows its neighbor will have its tail sticking out of its mouth. I'm your host, Peter Clote in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
More than 4 years ago, after nearly five decades of military rule, Burma embarked on a path toward democracy. A newly elected, largely civilian government took the reins in the spring of 2011 and gradually began to take important steps toward significant social, political, and economic reform. In November 2012, Barack Obama became the first sitting U.S. president to visit Burma. He recalled that experience during a recent press conference with Burmese politician and pro-democracy leader Aung San Suu Kyi at her home in Yangon. In the past 2 years, important changes have been made. The economy has begun to grow. Political prisoners have been set free. There are more newspapers and media outlets. Children have been released from the military. And these are all important changes that have opened up greater opportunity for the people of Burma, said President Obama. At the same time, it's clear how much hard work remains to be done and that many difficult choices still lie ahead, he said.
The process for reform is by no means complete or irreversible. For many, progress has not come fast enough or spread far enough. People need to feel safe in their homes and not be subject to arbitrary harassment by authorities or individuals acting with impunity. People need to be empowered to pursue their dreams. And as Burma approaches important national elections next year, it will be critical to ensure that all of Burma's people can participate in shaping the future of their country.
Now Burma needs to take the next important steps on the path to democracy. These include strengthening the rule of law, continued constitutional changes to move Burma more fully towards a civilian government, diffusing sectarian tensions among Burma's diverse ethnic groups, ending discrimination, providing greater security and economic opportunities for the Burmese people, and strengthening their human rights protections. 2 years ago, President Obama pledged that if Burma continued to progress toward democracy, the United States would help ensure Burma's success. We've made good on that pledge, said President Obama. The United States wants to reiterate that commitment to match continued reforms with greater support and friendships in the future.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.